Thus I have heard, once the Lord Buddha was staying among the Sakyans, that the school building in the mango grove belonging to the Vedanya family. And the first thing I noticed there, that those people who are applying to the Australian Taxation Office, saying that we qualify as a school building fund, that is something you can mention to the Australian Taxation Office, that the many times the monks used to stay at the school building fund. And a mango grove belonged to the Vedanya family. At that time, Nigantha Nataputta had just died at Pawa. Now, Nigantha Nataputta was otherwise known as Mahavira, who was the leader of the Jains. And it was one of those historical anomalies that the Buddha and Mahavira, leader of the Jains, they rose at the same time, just very close by to one another. Why that happens in history, the leaders, the founders of two great world religions, or at least big religions, arose contemporary. And at his death, the Nigantas were split into two parties, quarreling and disputing, fighting and attacking each other with wordy warfare. This is a stock phrase of how two people or two parties complain against each other. You don't understand this doctrine and discipline. I do. How could you understand this doctrine and discipline? Your way is all wrong. Mine is right. I am consistent. You aren't. You said last what you should have said first, and you said first what you should have said last. What took you so long to think up has been refuted. Your argument has been overthrown. You're defeated. Go on, save your doctrine. Get out of that if you can. Now, does that remind you of the parliamentary question time debates? To which, is that so quick that I'm mentioning this, from your two friends who came out of Perth from Sydney to visit their nephew, who's 30 years old, who has cerebral palsy. So he's got an emotional age of 8, but the things he likes listening to are things like the Wiggles and also parliamentary question time, which he thinks is even funnier. So I don't know if he's got an emotional age of 8, or that young or 30-year-old boy, girl, or whatever he is very, very intelligent. You would have thought the Nigantas, Nataputta's disciples, were bent on killing each other. Even the white-robed lay followers were disgusted, displeased, and repelled when they saw that their doctrine and discipline so ill-proclaimed, so unedifyingly displayed, and so ineffectual in calming the passions, having been proclaimed by one not fully enlightened and now with his support gone, without an arbiter, say a mediator. So this thing is very appropriate to our Buddhist Society of Western Australia new constitution, which was passed yesterday, which has appropriate mediation procedures. So this will never happen to us. Now the novice Chunda, who had spent the rains at Pawa, that's that particular area, came to Samagama to see the Venerable Ananda. Saluting him, he sat down to one side and said, "Sir, Nigantha Nataputta has just died at Pawa." And he related what had happened. And the Venerable Ananda said, "Chunda, that is something that ought to be reported to the Blessed Lord, the Buddha. Let us go and tell him." "Very good, sir," said Chunda. So that's not our Chunda, who's currently at Newbury. This is the old Chunda. We have all these old names, you know, from the time of the Buddha. And I let the monks choose their names, and they do that by looking at some of the inspiring monks or nuns in the time of the Buddha, so they have something to live up to. "Such being the case, Chunda, a disciple cannot live according to that doctrine and maintain proper conduct, nor live by it, but deviates from it. To him one might say, 'Friend, this is what you have received, and you've had your opportunity. Your teacher was not fully enlightened. You cannot live according to that doctrine, but deviate from it.' In this case, Chunda, the teacher is to blame, the doctrine is to blame, but the pupil is praiseworthy, because they deviate, they change the doctrine, change from the doctrine. And if anyone were to say to that pupil, 'Come now, Reverend Sir, and practice according to the doctrine proclaimed and given out by your teacher,' then one who urged that, the thing being urged, and the one who so practiced, would all gain much demerit. Why? Because the doctrine is ill proclaimed. But here Chunda is a teacher who is not fully enlightened, and the disciple who lives according to that doctrine and conforms to it might say, one might say to him, friend, what you have received is no good. Your opportunity is a poor one. Your teacher is not fully enlightened. His teaching is ill proclaimed. But yet you continue to live according to it. In that case, the teacher, the doctrine, and the disciple are all to blame. And if someone were to say, well, Reverend Sir, by following that system you'll be successful, the one who so recommended it, that which was recommended, and the one who on hearing such recommendation should make still greater efforts, would all gain much merit, because the doctrine is ill proclaimed. So on that, when you have a doctrine which is not properly proclaimed, from a teacher who is not fully enlightened, then you may expect people to argue afterwards. But if someone does realise that the teaching is not properly proclaimed, then it's probably best to leave it, follow another one. But here now is a teacher who is fully enlightened, the doctrine is well proclaimed, edifyingly displayed, effectual in calming the passions because of that enlightened teacher. So that's saying there's a sign that the teacher is enlightened because it's edifyingly displayed, and it is, you can see, it does effect in calming sort of anger and ill will, among other passions. But the disciple does not live up to that doctrine, but deviates from it. In that case, one might say to him, friend, you have failed, you have missed your opportunity. Your teacher was fully enlightened, the doctrine was well proclaimed, but you did not follow it, you deviate from it. In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, but the pupil is to blame. And if anyone were to say, well, Reverend Sir, you should follow the teaching proclaimed by your teacher, then the one who urged this, that which was urged, and the one who so practiced, would all gain much merit, because the doctrine is well proclaimed. Anyway, but now, Chunda, here is a teacher who is fully enlightened, the doctrine is well proclaimed, and the disciple, having taken it up, follows it, practices it properly, and keeping to it. Someone might say to him, friend, what have you received is good. Here is your opportunity, and you are following the doctrine of your teacher. In this case, the teacher and the doctrine are praiseworthy, and the pupil is also praiseworthy. And if anyone was to say to such a disciple, well, Reverend Sir, by following that system, you will be successful. Then the one who has thus commended it, and that which was commended, and the one who on hearing such commendation should make still greater effort, would all gain much merit. Why? Because that is so when the doctrine and discipline are well proclaimed, edifyingly displayed, and effectual in calming the Buddha. calming the passions, because of the fully enlightened teacher and supreme Buddha. So in brief here, that if somebody if there is a really good teacher, fully enlightened, you can see that because it's well proclaimed, and it is edifyingly displayed, and it calms passions, then fine, you should follow it. And if you follow it, that's great merit for you. I'm just summarizing here. And anyone who encourages you to keep following it, then that's good karma for them. And I often mention this, if somebody ever wants to ordain in a really good tradition, and somebody says, oh, no, don't ordain, don't follow, don't practice it, then actually people make lots of bad karma. It's like when you're a child, a son or a daughter wants to become a monk or a nun. And people say, oh, no, don't do that. The people who stop their children becoming monks or nuns, they make bad karma. They may think, oh, you know, I'm being ashamed if my child was a monk or was a nun. If you discourage them, it's bad karma for the parents. Well, I used to mention that to the chief of in Bickfield's temple, Dr. Kesu Dharmananda, and I mentioned to him that for especially Chinese families, that they get so inspired when somebody becomes a monk or a nun, as long as it's not their son or their daughter. Anyway, but now, Chunda, suppose a teacher has arisen in the world, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, and the doctrine is well proclaimed, effectual in calming the passions because of that teacher. But the disciples have not fully mastered that true Dhamma. They have not practiced the full purity of the holy life, and has not become clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding, and has not been sufficiently grounded amongst them. Being still in the course of being well proclaimed among humans at the time of the teachings passing away from them. That way, turning to the teacher's death would be a sad thing for their disciples. Why, they would think, our teacher arose in the world for us, an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha, whose doctrine was well proclaimed, but we did not fully master the true Dhamma. As long as it was well proclaimed among humans, and now our teacher has passed away from among us. That way, the teacher's death would be a sad thing for their disciples. Oh boy. Now I've got to. Every now and again. This little thing. Whenever I get really into these things, what happens is the Mara comes along and presses something. Okay, hey, great. But Chunda, if the holy life is so circumstanced, and there is no teacher who is senior of long standing, long ordained, mature and advanced in seniority, then in such a case the holy life will be imperfect. But if such a teacher exists, then the holy life can be perfected in such a case. If in such a case there is such a senior teacher, but if there are no senior disciples amongst the monks who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have attained peace from bondage, that's Nibbana, who are able to proclaim the true Dhamma, able to refute any opposing doctrines that might arise by means of the true Dhamma, having done so to give a grounded exposition of Dhamma, then the holy life is not perfected. In such cases, if there are such senior teachers and such senior disciples, but there are no monks of middle standing with these qualities, or despite the presence of these, no junior monks with these qualities, no senior disciples amongst the nuns, no middle ranking or junior nuns, no white robe lay followers, male or female, celibate or otherwise, or if the teaching does not prosper and flourish, is not widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide, even if these conditions are fulfilled, has not gained the first place in public support, then the holy life is not perfect. If, however, all these conditions are fulfilled, then the holy life is perfected. So this is once a person passes away, how do we know that the holy life or the path has been perfected, so it will last a long time? But, this is paragraph 14, but Chunda, I have now arisen in the world as an arahat, fully enlightened Buddha. The Dhamma is well proclaimed. My disciples are proficient in the Dhamma. The full purity of the holy life has been made clear and evident to them in the logic of its unfolding. But now I am an aged teacher of long standing who went forth a long time ago, and my life is coming to its close. However, there are senior teachers amongst the monks who are experienced, trained, skilled, who have obtained enlightenment, that's the peace from bondage, able to proclaim the true Dhamma, able to refute by means of the Dhamma any opposing doctrines that may arise, and having done so, give a grounded exposition of Dhamma. And there are middle-ranking monks who are disciplined and experienced. There are novices who are disciples. There are senior, middle-ranking, and novice bhikkhunis who are disciples. There are white-robed lay followers, male and female, celibate and non-celibate. And the holy life I proclaim prospers and flourishes, is widespread, widely known, proclaimed far and wide, well proclaimed among humans. So what we're saying here is that that is showing the fulfillment of the holy life. And I hope you notice that it wasn't just great monks and senior monks. It was also the bhikkhunis as well as the laymen and laywomen. And if those haven't been established, then the holy life, that means the sasana, the teachings, Buddhism if you like, is not well established. So, to have a well-founded Buddhism, you need all of those four, and in particular here, the bhikkhunis. I mention that because sometimes they are left out. Anyway, pause. Any questions? Comments? Complaints? Yeah.
Thanks, Ajahn. I have a comment. As you were reading through the passages, yeah. I was thinking about organizational development and how it parallels that. And it's an area that I work in, so I was reflecting that that's what a CEO would want or a management team would want. So it's really interesting seeing that parallel. I did want to ask you about laymen and laywomen. In particular, do the scriptures or do they actually differentiate between men and women? So laymen, laywomen, and the bhikkhunis, obviously that's...
That's right. There's just four main distinctions there. But there's, just to make a distinction there, but it's only just laymen, laywomen. What's the distinction? You may say young, old. You can make distinctions in many cases. Yeah, inclusive. They didn't specifically mention LGBTQIA, but that would be assumed there. So amongst everybody. Yes.
So this, historical dispute among the Jains, is that true?
No one really knows, because once the Jains seem to be historically very powerful at the time of the Buddha, but then they tended to disappear and lose a lot of their power and prestige, but they were revived later on. I don't know when, what the century was, were I think 5th or 6th century or something. And then apparently they thought it was a new type of religion, but they actually found that they had the same sort of teachings as the Mahavira. So it was an interesting development of the Jains. Then we have some of the Jain teachings, which were written in, now I think it was hybrid Sanskrit. And I got very excited once when I was doing some research, because they give a little bit of a window into what Buddhism was from somebody else's eyes. So obviously the Buddhism would always praise, unfortunately it's hagiography, praise their superiority and, would just put down the opposition. But here we have the Jaina suttas, and there they are praising obviously them and putting down the Buddhists. And one thing which I noticed years and years ago going through those texts, we have a copy over in the library in Bodhinyana, and there they said, these Buddhists, just how stupid they are. They believe there's only the five khandhas and nothing else. And to me that was a very wonderful piece of information to saying that even in the early teachings, so there was no idea of some sort of self or soul beyond the five khandhas. A little bit of extra because it's a document which is from the opposition, describing what Buddhism was regarded as an outsider. Yeah, but that's what they said. They put it down, said that was obviously wrong, they said, but it actually gives an understanding of what the Buddhas were teaching. Anyway, now what it says in starting paragraph 16, among all the teachers now existing in the world, Chunda, I see none who has attained to such a position of fame and following as I have. Of all the orders and groups in the world, I see none as famous and well followed as my Sangha of monks. If anyone were to refer to any holy one by the Sangha of monks, that would also be the Sangha of nuns as well. If anyone were to refer to any holy way of life as being fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity, it is this holy life that they would be describing. And it was Uddaka Ramaputta, who was one of those very early teachings of the Buddha before he became enlightened, who used to say, he sees but does not see. It was almost like a Zen koan. And what does it mean? What is it that seeing one does not see? You can see the blade of a well-sharpened razor, but not its edge. That is what he meant by saying he sees but not see. He spoke in reference to a low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble thing of no spiritual significance, a mere razor. But if one were to use that expression properly, he sees but does not see, it would be like this. What he sees is a holy way of life which is fully successful and perfect, with nothing lacking and nothing superfluous, well proclaimed in the perfection of its purity. If you were to deduct anything from it, thinking in this way it will be purer, you do not see it. And if he were to add anything to it, thinking in this way it will be more complete, then he does not see it. That is the meaning of the saying, he sees but does not see. Therefore, Chunda, if anyone were to refer to any holy way of life as being fully successful and perfect, it is this holy life that they would be describing. So, that's a bit triumphant, to say the least. But just to add something a little bit extra to that, you know, you may have, I don't think Ajahn Brahmani may have come to yet in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the a person came up to the Buddha to ask him, just towards the end of his life, is it possible to actually to find enlightenment in any other religions or holy lives other than yours? And how did the Buddha say that? Can you become an arahat, fully enlightened, say, in the Jain path, or in, you know, what we say these days, in the Christian path, or in the Jewish path, or Muslim path? And the Buddha said, very beautifully, wherever you find the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find enlightened beings. So it's not what you call yourself. It's actually how you practice. That is the most important. That make sense? So I like that one because it cuts against the old idea. The Buddhists are the best. And are the Buddhists? Who are the best Buddhists? The Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, or the Hahayana? Some people say we're the best. And of our tradition, which is the best part of Theravada? Which is the best part of the forest tradition, Theravada? Which is the best part of the Bodhinyana tradition, Theravada? Which is the best part? And that sort of sectioning off of names and lineages, it begs the question that it doesn't matter what lineage you're in. It's what you make of that, your practice. So wherever you find the Eightfold Path being practiced, there you will find enlightened beings. Make the point, okay? Okay. Now this part, therefore, Chunda, all you to whom I have taught these truths that I have realized by super knowledge, not super knowledge, I think the word is like really internal knowledge, should come together and recite them, setting meaning beside meaning and expression beside expression, without dissension, in order that this holy life may continue and be established for a long time for the profit and happiness of the many, out of compassion for the world and for the benefit, profit and happiness of heavenly beings and humans. And what are the things that you should recite together? They are the four foundations of mindfulness, the four right efforts, the four roads to power, the five spiritual faculties, the five mental powers, the seven factor of enlightenment, the Noble Eightfold Path. These are the things you should recite together. Now, recall that at that time, none of those things was written down. So they wanted them to be recited amongst the monks and nuns, and for them to be, even some of the lay people would do that as well, and they would recite them together and make sure there was no errors. So it was an oral tradition for many years, many centuries actually. And thus you must train yourself, being assembled in harmony and without dissension. And this is especially referring to what would happen with the Nigantas, the Jains, who were arguing. So how to stop that arguing? If a fellow in the holy life quotes Dharma in the assembly, and if you think they have either misunderstood the sense or expressed it wrongly, you should neither applaud nor reject it. But you say to him, "Friend, if you mean such and such, you should put it either like this or like that, which is more appropriate. Or if you say such and such, you mean either this or that, which is more appropriate." If he replies, "The meaning is better expressed like this than like that. The sense of this expression is this rather than that, then his words should be neither rejected nor disparaged, but you should explain to him carefully the correct meaning and expression." So you don't reject or disparage somebody, you just carefully, quietly, just ask if he really, is that what he said, if that's what he meant, and to advise it would be better expressed like this or better expressed like that. So, in other words, you don't argue, you don't sort of have a brawl, you very calmly and with friendliness say, "Oh, you must have expressed it in the wrong way. Or you must have misunderstood it. I misunderstood what you said." Again, Chunda, if a fellow in the holy life quotes Dharma in the assembly and you think they have misunderstood the sense, though he has expressed it correctly, you should neither applaud nor reject it, but should say to them, "Friend, these words can mean either this or that. Which sense is the more appropriate?" And if he replies they mean this, then his words should be neither rejected nor disparaged. You should explain to him carefully the correct meaning. And similarly, if you think he's got the right meaning but expressed it wrongly, you should explain it to him carefully the correct meaning and expression. But if you think he's got the right meaning and expressed it correctly, you should say "good," or rather "sadhu," and should applaud and congratulate him or her, saying, "We are lucky, we are most fortunate to find in you, friend, a companion in the holy life who is so well versed in both the meaning and the expression." Just a little bit of advice, not to argue with people, but just say, "What did you mean? And did you actually say it appropriately, or is it misunderstood what you said?" And then if they get it right, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Any questions? Okay. Chunda, I do not teach you a Dharma for restraining the corruptions, defilements that arise in the present life alone. I do not teach a Dharma merely for their destruction in future lives, but one for the restraining in this life as well for their destruction in future lives. In other words, it is, again, for the happiness here and now, in this life, right now, but also for any future lives. Accordingly, Chunda, let the robe I have allowed you be simply for warding off the cold, for warding off the heat, for warding off the touch of gadfly, mosquito, wind, sun, and creeping things, just so as to protect your modesty. This is what we need just to survive. What is the purpose of a robe? Of your clothes, if you're especially a monastic, it's not to have the latest fashion of robes, it's not to have them. I actually heard this, that some community of monks, they got the best satin from, I think, Switzerland or something, cost a fortune for their robes. I mean, that's going a little bit too far, I reckon. But it was just because they were the important monks at the time. So it's not to do with fashion. It's only to, again, to ward off the heat. And even some monks, some years ago in Bodhinyana Monastery, sort of I censored them because they only wanted cotton robes instead of like polyester. Whatever. I said, look, whatever we have, you know, in the storeroom, you take that. You don't have to have always a cotton robe. You're lucky it's just for warding off the heat and cold, for warding off the touch of insects, and for modesty. Let the alms food I have allowed you be just enough for the support and sustenance of the body, for keeping it unimpaired, for the furtherance of the holy life, with the thought, thus I shall eliminate the former feeling of hunger without giving rise to a new one of overeating. In that way, I shall live without fault and in comfort. So that's the reflection which we do often, if not every day, when monks eat their food. Why are we eating it for? Let the lodging I have allowed you be simple for warding off the cold, warding off the heat, warding off the touch of gadfly, mosquito, wind, sun, and creeping things, just for allaying the perils of the seasons and for the enjoyment of seclusion. So that's why we have simple huts. And especially, I always mention, for the enjoyment of seclusion, having a bit of solitude, which is so rare in these days. So I've been out and about for the last 2 weeks, and I must admit I'm looking forward to my cave this evening, some seclusion. And Wudum, the alms food, lodgings, and they're the provision of medicines and necessities for the treatment of sickness that I have allowed you. Just be for warding off feelings of sickness that have arisen and for the maintenance of health. So this is the basic requirements for our living, for our existence. And sometimes anything extra is to be regarded as extra. I'm not quite sure if I was, mentioning in the talk on, on Friday night, or I may have been talking with some of the monks, that, you know, should we really be so bothered with having security cameras and walls and guards, especially in monasteries? When? Why do people want to steal from us? If people really want to steal from Bodhinyana Monastery, I'm getting a bit concerned that our things which we have there are too expensive. That, you know, we have too many valuables. And you think, well, what do we really need? As long as they leave us some robes, and we have alms food, and we have just a lodging, simply for warding off the cold and the enjoyment of seclusion, and medicines just for warding off feelings of sickness, that's basic necessities. Unfortunately, our local councils are building approvals and development approvals, and they say we need much more for our lodgings. But sometimes you wonder about the simplicity, and, you know, if somebody does steal from a monastery, is it the case that monastery's got a little bit too much? It's an interesting reflection. Anyway, any questions or comments on that so far before I get on to one of my favourite parts of this sutta, one of the reasons why I even decided to talk about it today. Any questions? Comments? Okay. Now, it may be, Chunda, that wanderers of other sects might say, the ascetics who follow the Sakyan, the Buddhist monks and nuns, lay men, lay women, are addicted to a life of devotion to pleasure. If so, they should be asked, what kind of a life of devotion to pleasure, friend? For such a life can take many different forms. There are, Chunda, four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble, not conducive to welfare, not leading to disenchantment, to dispassion, to cessation, to tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. And you know what the word, Chunda, four kinds of life devoted to pleasure which are low, that word is hina. That is literally the hinayana. And we find out what that is afterwards. So it was a word which was misappropriated just to put down some of the early Buddhist teachings. But the Hinayana was like a low life devoted to pleasure. So what are the four lives which are ennoble, not conducive to welfare, not ending to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana? What are they? Firstly, a foolish person takes pleasure and delight in killing living beings. Secondly, someone takes pleasure and delight in taking that which is not given. Thirdly, someone takes pleasure and delight in telling lies. Fourthly, someone gives himself up to the indulgence in and enjoyment of the pleasure of the five senses. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, not leading to disenchantment, to enlightenment, to nirvana. And one of the parts of that which is always fascinating to me to say there is pleasure. People can actually get a really weird type of pleasure in even to killing other beings. Why could they do that? For why would they go hunting? You know, for pleasure. It's weird. Maybe it's because they feel they have power. The stealing. Why do people just like the buzz of trying to steal something? Venerable Metaji pointed me to a little article about a 104-year-old woman in England. It's her birthday, and said the one thing she'd never done before in her life was be arrested and taken to jail. So it was her wish on her 104th birthday to have the police come and arrest her and take her to jail. She hadn't done any crime at all. She'd lived a totally free life, but she thought before she died, she just wanted to experience what it was like to be arrested and taken to jail. And of course, the police obliged her, and she had her wish fulfilled. And apparently, while she was driving along some roads in England, the police asked her, "Do you want the sirens on?" She said, "Oh, yeah." So there's a sort of pleasure in being arrested, I suppose. But I don't know. She just wanted to have a bit of fun as a 104-year-old. So that's one thing to put on your bucket list if you get that far. Obviously, it was just the police were very happy to oblige her and take her home afterwards. And also the enjoyment of the pleasures of the five senses. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are low, vulgar, not leading to disenchantment, to enlightenment, to nirvana. And it may be those of other sects say, "Ah, the followers of the Buddha given to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told no, for they would be not speaking correctly about you. They would be slandering you with false and untrue statements." Unfortunately, there are some monks and nuns that will be true of them. But if really good monks and nuns, they're not devoted to those four forms of pleasure seeking. However, there are chunda, these four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, to realization, to enlightenment, to nirvana. The four kinds of life devoted to pleasure. Are you interested? Because it leads to enlightenment. Woo. What are they? Firstly, a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, free from the five senses, free from unwholesome mental states, enters and remains in the first jhana, enters and remains in the second jhana, enters and remains in the third jhana, enters and remains in the fourth jhana. These are the four kinds of life devoted to pleasure, which are entirely conducive to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, realization, enlightenment, nirvana. The jhanas. So, if wanderers from other sects should say that the followers of the Sakyan are addicted to these four forms of pleasure seeking, they should be told, "Yeah, okay, we'll accept that." For they would be speaking correctly about you. They would not be slandering you with false or untrue statements. So, good monks, good nuns, good laymen, lay women, we're addicts to pleasure. So sometimes you say those things, just, what's going on here? Then such wanderers might ask, well then, those who are given to these four forms of pleasure seeking, how many fruits, how many benefits can they expect? And you should reply, they can expect four fruits, four benefits. What are they? The first is when a monk, by this destruction of the three fetters, has become a stream winner, no more subject to rebirth in the lower world, firmly established, just destined for full enlightenment. The second one is a monk by the, or nun, layman, laywoman, by the complete destruction of the three fetters and a reduction of greed, hatred and delusion, has become a once returner, and having returned only once more to this world, they will put an end to suffering. The third is when a monk by nun, layman, I should put a meditator in there, I haven't sort of just adjusted this yet, didn't have time, but nevertheless, when a meditator, by the complete destruction of the five lower fetters, has been spontaneously reborn, and there will reach Nibbana without returning from that world. And the fourth is when a monk, nun, layman, laywoman, by the destruction of the corruptions, the outflowings, the whatever, in this very life, has, by their own knowledge and realization, attained to arahatship, to the deliverance of heart and deliverance through wisdom. Such are the four fruits and four benefits that one given to these four forms of pleasure-seeking can expect. So if you give yourself to the four forms of pleasure-seeking of the jhanas, then if you're addicted, those are the results. Stream-winning, once-returning, non-returning, and full enlightenment. Any takers? I think many of you have heard that before, because in Buddhism, sometimes, especially in meditation traditions, they say if you're enjoying it, you might get attached. And you should answer them, yes, you may get attached, and even become enlightened. Sometimes attachment is always one of those words which people judge without considering it, and saying all attachments must be bad. But here is the Basarika Sutta, the delightful discourse where it says in particular that beautiful life is conducive to enlightenment. So indulge as much as you like. Have a good time. Be a good time monk. A good time nun. A good time layman. And a good time laywoman. Have a good time doing good, blissing out, and leaving the world. Any comments?
Yes,
yeah. Oh yeah, yeah. This passion, that's viraga. I prefer the meaning fading away.
Now, what I was going to ask you, for the last week I've been thinking about it. In fact, I was hoping to catch you just now in the hall. That's why I came in late.
Oh, okay.
You came around the other way.
I'm a very sneaky monk.
It was to ask you one Friday evening if you could give a talk on dispassion and covetousness for the world with all the problems that are going on, and especially in this last week. People are very caught up in it. They don't know when to stop, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It just goes on and on. Oh, isn't it terrible? Isn't it awful? And, you know, it's a long, long story. Whereas to my mind, this covers it quite a lot, that people will realize just how they are in the middle of it all, and yet they can step outside that.
That's a very lovely point. That some of what I was trying to say on a Friday night, even though I was quite tired, to know that sometimes when you're right in the middle of things, you cannot see clearly. And sometimes if you see things in a different way, sometimes people say, oh, you don't understand, because, you know, you're not following the herd. But I'd like you to step back and just to see just the way that we do. Again, the word covetousness and dispassion, it actually means the, in the Satipatthana Sutta, means the abandoning or restraint of the five hindrances. But nevertheless, the idea of covetousness for the market share of my religion, just the superiority of my views, the covetousness, you know, for not just material things, but for comfort and being right, being respected. And sometimes that's at the expense of others. As if I'm right, then other people must be wrong. And we can go much better than that. And that is just the little things like the simile of the elephant, that no one can actually have just all the information of an elephant if they're blind people. So that, you know, instead of arguing on who's right and who's wrong, we combine our information, our experiences. Not actually just fighting who's right and who's wrong, but actually just combining without anyone feeling pride that theirs is the best. Mm-hmm. That would help out a lot.
I was mainly also thinking of the anxiety that is going around. There's such a lot of anxiety with all this bad news.
Yeah.
And that's where I felt, well, Friday night maybe you could go into it in a bit deeper way, just wholly on that subject, that yes, you can step outside that. You don't have to be caught up. As I say to people, well, you pray for these people, or if you've got money for donations, do that sort of thing. But to hang on to all of this sadness is not good for anybody, especially for the world.
I totally concur with that, but anxiety, fear sells newspapers. It makes people look at the evening news. It makes people tune in to the social media. Unfortunately, if you don't have any bad news happening in the world, you look at movies. And many of the movies apparently are end of the world. That everything is going to end. But it's usually in the movies somebody, usually with a Superman or something, they save the world at the very, 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 very last. But it still gets people anxious. And they're always fearful. And they just wonder what will happen next. And just every now and again you see some wisdom coming in the newspapers. But that wisdom I usually find in the comics. I must admit, the comic strips are some of the wisest pieces of information. If anything, I would like Snoopy, because Snoopy is an American citizen, I hope. They should run for the White House, because Snoopy Dog was incredibly wise. One of the things which he would say is one of the favorite sayings, when his friend Charlie Brown told him, one day everyone must die. And Snoopy replied, yes, but most days we don't die. And I thought, that's so true. You know, Barbara, one day you will die. But most days, you're not going to die.
Thank you.
So you can think, one day I'm going to die. It makes you so anxious. But most days, you're not going to die. That's looking at the 998 good bricks in a wall, not the two bad ones, which is an antidote to anxiety and negativity. So thank you for that. Okay. Well, what would I go down there for? Okay. Then, having heard that this path is a path of addiction to pleasure to become enlightened, such wanderers might say the doctrines of the Sakyan followers, the Buddhists, are not well founded. They should be told, friend, the Lord who knows and sees has taught and proclaimed to his disciples principles which are not to be transgressed as long as life shall last. Just as a locking post, an iron post which is deeply based, well planted, unshakable, immovable, they used to put those posts in the ground to entrances to village, bathing places which were safe, and you still see those Asoka pillars in India these days. And that's, well, how long ago? About 2,200 years or something. Old, and they're still there. Amazingly, they haven't decayed, hardly at all. And any monk who is an arahat, whose corruptions are destroyed, who's lived the life, done what is to be done, laid down the burden, gained the true goal, who has completely destroyed the fetter of being, and is liberated by supreme insight, is incapable of doing 9 things. This is anyone who is enlightened, not just monks, nuns, laymen, laywomen. They are incapable of deliberately taking the life of a living being. They just can't do it. They're incapable of taking what is not given so as to constitute theft. They're incapable of sexual intercourse. They're incapable of telling a deliberate lie. They're incapable of storing up goods for sensual indulgence as they formerly did in the household life. They're incapable of acting wrongly through attachment. They're incapable of acting wrongly through hatred. They're incapable of acting wrongly through delusion. And they're incapable of acting wrongly through fear. These are the 9 things which an enlightened being cannot do. And that's an interesting sort of passage there, because these are things which, if you are enlightened, it's impossible for you to do. You can't deliberately take the life of a living being, even if it's to save the whole world. You cannot take what is to steal things, sexual intercourse, telling a deliberate lie, capable of storing up goods, capable of acting wrongly, through that's actually desire, should be the right translation, through hatred, through delusion, or through fear. Those are the 4 what we call the 4 ways of to consider before you make any decision at all. Never act out of a personal desire, ill will, stupidity, or fear. Yeah.
Can an arahan break any of the Vinaya?
Yes, they can, but it's some of those Vinaya, the Patimokkha precepts, like maybe forgetting the time of day, and they eat their meal beyond noon. So we're only supposed to eat in the morning time. Or things like receiving alcohol, like I did when a few years ago, is there any Thai people here? Oh, good. Because one of the Thai donors here, I think their granddad passed away, and their grandfather loved his whiskey. Now he passed away, and they had the crazy idea of the only way to get their father up in heaven a bottle of whiskey is actually to offer it to a monk, and then because of the karmic sort of way of things done, then a bottle of whiskey would appear in heaven, you know, to their grandfather when they dedicate the merits. But they knew that I would never accept a bottle of whiskey, so what they did it was in Bodhinyana, had a big bucket of requisites, you know, with toothpaste and soap and tea, and it was all covered. And so they offered it. Those have been to Bodhinyana Monastery or here, they offer these things in the morning. You put your cloth out, you just accept it into your hand, and then they take it away. So all the Anagarikas took away all this stuff, and then about 20 minutes later, one of the Anagarikas came up and said, "Ajahn Brahm, do you know what you've just done?" I said, what? Because they opened up the package, and they took things out of the bucket, and right down the bottom was a bottle of Johnny whiskey. They'd hidden it so that I could receive it. So, yeah, I've received a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey, but not intentionally at all. And that, you know, that is breaking the precept. But of course, there's no real fault.
That is not intentional.
It was not intention, yeah. But
so, why is that a breaking of the precept?
Because we have to be more careful. Yeah, but
it's not intentional.
Not intentional, yes. So they divide the precepts for monks and nuns into what they call loka vajja, and what's the other one is panyati vajja. And so loka vajja means where people in the world will criticize you for that. It's the wrong thing to do. And panyati vajja is just breaking like the ceremonial rules or the way of. People in the world would never sort of criticize you for that. Or even just these four nuns, two of them became very well known. They had some wine gums sent from Canada. And I thought it was just wine gums. But actually they had real wine in it. And so they just shared it amongst themselves, these four monks. I was there at the time. And then they started behaving really strange. And they were almost drunk because they hadn't had any alcohol at all for years. So, you know, just a small amount of alcohol, they were just so sensitive. And they started laughing and messing around. And then we said, what are you doing? And then we found out they had wine gums, had real wine in it. Totally unintentional because they never really realized there was such stuff in it. So that's why when you make it a rule, then there's no karmic consequences, but it makes you more careful next time. And so you can tell that there's no blame, but there is, tell the lay people afterwards, no, please don't do that. And of course, what happened to the whiskey? It's quite expensive stuff, apparently. So they said, what should we do with it? Shall we give it to, you know, some of the friends who actually do drink whiskey? They said, no, just pour it down the sink. So it's poured down the sink. Good quality Johnny Walker.
Why
is this so happy? Anyway. So anyway, it's nice to see those things. So if any of you ever see someone who claims to be enlightened, to be an arahat, you can actually check them out. Because that's quite clear. These are things they're incapable of doing. Or, such wanderers might say, as regards to past times, the ascetic Gotama displays boundless knowledge and insight, but not about the future, as to what it will be and how it will be. Now this is, can the Buddha and enlightened beings predict the future? So he says he can't even say much about the future and what it will be and how it will be. That would be to suppose that knowledge and insight about one thing are to be produced by knowledge and insight about something else, as fools imagine. As regards the past, the Tathagata, the Buddha, has knowledge of past lives. He can remember as far back as he wishes. As for the future, the knowledge born of enlightenment arises in him. This is the last birth, there'll be no more becoming. That's the extent of it. Not what will happen in the future in thousands of years' time. So the Buddha never predicted the future. The one place where there was a prediction of the future, which many people said was totally out of character, and it doesn't make much sense at all, and also the fact that the Buddha turned out to be wrong, if he actually did say it, was when he ordained bhikkhunis. Someone said, oh, if you ordain bhikkhunis, the teaching would only last another 500 years. You may have read that, and as many people say, this doesn't make any sense at all. It couldn't have really been put in there by the Buddha, because number one, he never predicted the future, and number two, Buddhism is going well, and it's a long time after 500 years. And it is Panchasatta, it's 500, not 5,000. So sometimes you can pick out in these teachings where it's obviously something that's been inserted in there, and it's out of character of a Buddha. He doesn't predict the future. So, if the past... Oh, any questions on that, by the way? Yeah.
There was another case where the Buddha predicted the future. He said that in the future there will be some yellow, there will be monks who wear yellow rags and claim to be the part of the Sangha.
Yeah.
And that seems to be a true prediction.
Yeah. There was some saying times of the future, but that was just something not saying a particular time, a particular place. Also predicted that all the seas would dry up one day, and this earth would actually be molten and be vaporized. And you know, that's actually part of a science. So there is some general predictions just about how things work in this world, but nothing specific with time. It's almost just, you know, evolution, devolution, but no specific dates or times. Yeah.
In that regard, is that simply an extrapolation from past knowledge?
Say. Oops. Yes, exactly. Just like, you know, I can predict that, you know, you'll die one day. So you don't know when. Hope it's a long time, but you never know. So, and
well,
that's...
You can even predict the standard deviation of when I'll likely pass away.
Yeah, you could. That's a good mathematician. Standard deviations. But that was just saying that in the future there will be decay, corruption. It's one of the things which even, you know, Ajahn Chah taught me. You have a good monastery, when it's young it grows and it's very pure, and then after a while it will decay. And, you know, for all the efforts, you know, that if I'm a leader of Bodhidharma Monastery, in the end it will become decadent. This is nature of things. We try and keep it as pure as possible. And the only way that you can keep it as pure as possible and to keep on the future is to have the old branch monasteries. So it's like a tree. Now the tree just gives fruits and the fruits spread to different places, and the old tree eventually has its life and it falls over. It's decayed, it's dead. So that's monasteries are like that. And traditions, Buddhist Society of West Australia, please excuse me, it one day it will sort of decay and become just corrupt. And that's not a prediction based on so we can see how things are going. It's just the nature of institutions. And to keep it pure, you always have to have some sort of renovation. So I'm just going through a sort of period where good people just come and form other little monasteries or other ways of doing things in different places. Even Ajahn Chah used to say that Thai Buddhism was a rotten tree. But then, from many rotten trees is very good fruits. And those fruits make other good trees. And that's the nature of our world. You understand? That's not putting things down, but it's just the nature of trying to keep things pure and well and good. So, you know, you can actually say that you're in a good time when in Perth there's a pretty good status of standard of practice. But be careful, don't, and I say this and I get into trouble again, don't give the monks and nuns too much. I saw that happen in even Wat Pa Phong, Ajahn Chah's monastery. It was a very, very simple monastery. It was actually maybe too austere. But then people didn't like going to give gifts to the city monasteries because they got corrupt. So they began to give all of their donations to the forest monasteries. So they became corrupt. And I said, how can you stop that? It's very tough. But anyway, so be careful. You can look after the monks and the nuns, look after the Buddhist society, but be careful just not to just go over the top with elaborate adornments. Keep it simple.
Does that make sense? Okay.
Here we go. So, if the past refers to what is factual, not fables, to what is of advantage and to what is not of advantage, the Tathagata makes no reply, talking about the past. If it refers to factual, not fabulous, but which is not of advantage, the Tathagata makes no reply. But if the past refers to what is factual, not fabulous in the sense of just myth, and which is of benefit, then the Tathagata knows the right time to reply. The same applies to the future and the present. Therefore, Chunda, the Tathagata is one who declares the time, in fact, the advantage, the Dharma, the discipline. That is why it's called Tathagata. In other words, that even if you do know something of the past, if it's of use, then fine. If it's not of use, then be quiet. And Chunda, whatever in this world, with its devas and maras and brahmas, with its ascetics and brahmas, its princes and people, is seen by people, heard, sensed, cognized, whatever was achieved, sought after, mentally pondered upon, all that has been fully understood by the Tathagata. That's why it's called Tathagata. What does he mean by that? It's not the content of what everyone has experienced or achieved, but it's just the underlying principles to that. That is why it's called Tathagata, between the night in which the Tathagata gains supreme enlightenment and the night in which attains the Nibbana element without remainder, whatever he proclaims, says or explains is so, not otherwise. That is why it's called a Tathagata. And if of this world with its devas and maras, brahmas, ascetics, brahmins, all the different types of beings, Tathagata is the unvanquished conqueror, the seer and ruler of all. That's why it's called Tathagata. Does the Buddha rule anybody? Does he conquer anybody? Of course, not in the conventional sense. It's a metaphor. Or such wanderers might say, does the Tathagata, the Buddha, exist after death? Is that true in any other view? Foolish. Or does the Tathagata not exist after death? Does he both exist and not exist, neither exist nor not exist? That has not been revealed by the Lord. And then they might say, why has the Buddha not revealed this? They should be told, it's not conducive to welfare, to Dharma, to the higher holy life, to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, realization, enlightenment, Nibbana. That is why the Lord has not revealed it. In other words, it doesn't really help the holy life. Or they might say, well friend, what has the ascetic Gotama revealed? What has he taught? They should be told, suffering, the arising of suffering, cessation of suffering, the path leading to cessation of suffering. That has been declared by the Lord. Something which is, you know, suffering in this end. You feel that. So the philosophy which you can waste a lot of time contemplating, get the sort of the wisdom coming up first, and then you can answer those four questions. And so why has this been declared by the Buddha? They should be told that is conducive to welfare, to Dharma, the higher holy life, to perfect disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, tranquility, realization, enlightenment, and Nibbana. That is why the Lord has revealed it. Okay, how are we going here? Oh, almost finished. Amazing. So that sometimes the Buddha never expected it to be a philosophical teaching, but more like a practical teaching, a practice of, you know, where you're at. That, you know, you have the anxiety and the suffering and the grief in this world. Those Four Noble Truths, that's more important. If anybody is grieving a relation or anxious about the state of the world or worried about sickness, then something which is far more relevant, just why? What's the cause of such suffering, physical and emotional? Is there a way beyond it? And what is that path beyond it? And of course that's the Four Noble Truths. Chunda, those bases of speculation about the beginnings of things which I have explained to you as they should be explained, should I now explain to you as they should not be explained, and likewise the future? What are the speculations about the past? There are spiritual seekers who say and believe the soul and the world are eternal. The soul and the world are not eternal. The soul and the world are both eternal and not eternal. The soul and the world are neither eternal nor not eternal. And if any of you have ever been to India, you know that where we would actually ask one question and think only one possibility was there, that sometimes there's many possibilities. What does it mean by the soul and the world are both eternal and not eternal? They're neither eternal nor not eternal. It seems that many permutations are there just for the sake of making the permutation having no really deep meaning. But people like to think. The soul and the world are self-created, they are created by another, they are both created and created by another, they are neither self-created nor created by another, but have arisen by chance, and similarly with regard to pleasure and pain. Nayachunda, I go to those ascetics and Brahmins who hold any of these views, and if being asked they confirm they do hold such views, I do not admit their claims. Why? Because Chunda, different beings hold different opinions on such matters, nor do I consider such theories equal to my own, unless still less superior. I am less superior in regard to the higher exposition. As for those basis of speculation about the beginning of things which I have explained to you as they should be explained, why should I now explain them to you as they should not be explained? And what about those speculations about the future? There are some ascetics and Brahmins who say the soul after death is material and healthy, immaterial, both, neither. The self is conscious and after death unconscious, both, neither. Both conscious and not conscious. Sounds like Schrodinger's cat to me. For those of you who know the Copenhagen interpretation of quantum physics. No, Schrodinger's cat. Okay, maybe I'll give a talk about that another time. And yeah, okay. So, why does the Buddha not have those speculations about the past and the future? And again, because they do not help at all. Nayachunda, what did the Buddha actually say? One of those sayings which comes from the suttas is where the Buddha says, the beginning, origin of the world and the end of this world can be found in your own body and mind. Which I thought was a very, very cool teaching. So if you want to find out where this world began, where it came from, see where the world ends, it's in this body and mind. In other words, don't look outside, go inside. And that's the path of the Eightfold Path. And Chunda, for the destruction of all such views about the past and the future, for transcending those views, I have taught and laid down the four foundations of mindfulness, the Satipatthana. What are the four? Here, Chunda, a monk dwells, mindful of the body, experience, mind and dhammas, the four Satipatthanas. And as you know from other teachings, instead of calling it feeling, vedana, I think it's much more accurate to call it just experience. The experience of any one of the six senses. Mindful of the body, experience, mind and dhammas. And where it says in Satipatthana Sutta, that body in the body, that's not what the sutta actually says, that's the idiom. It means just being mindful of the body. Ardent, knowing the purpose and mindful, having restrained the five hindrances. That is where you see covetousness and grief for the world. That's a nice little couple of words, but it's not what it means in the Satipatthana. It's a translation which was done by Rice Davids over 100 years ago, which has been stuck there, but everyone should know, and it's just so clear from the suttas, that phrase refers to the five hindrances having been restrained. That is how to undergo the destruction of such views about past and the future, and for transcending them, I have taught and laid down the four foundations of mindfulness. So instead of answering those views and just getting into an argument about, you know, what happens after death, you know, for an enlightened being, and where everything started from, the four foundations of mindfulness, having abandoned the five hindrances, this is where those answers can be found out for yourself, so you don't need to argue with others. And during this time, the Venerable Upawana was standing behind the Lord Buddha, fanning him. These were the days we did not have aircon, when a good attendant would have a fan. That's more like it. And he said, it's wonderful, Lord, it's marvelous. Lord, this discourse of Dhamma is delightful, highly delightful. What is the name of this discourse? Well, Upawana, you can remember it as the delightful discourse. Thus the Lord Buddha spoke, then Upawana rejoiced and was delighted with his words. So ends the delightful discourse. So, any comments on that? Yes, John.
Always understood by the sutta what the sutta says, that Ananda always assisted the Buddha, but lately in the suttas, what has been covered, it seems as though there was always two. There was Ananda and another monk fanning the Buddha. Would that be correct?
Not always, because sometimes the Ananda would not be there, somebody else would be fanning the Buddha. Or be looking after the Buddha. Not always the same attendant. Imagine if it was the same attendant. That would be a bit unfair.
There's two, because take, for example, when the Buddha was passing away, Ananda was there, and there was another monk fanning him, and the Buddha asked him to move away so the devas could see him. So that means there'll be two.
Yeah. Sometimes, and even Ananda would not always be in attendance, would be having his time. Because at that time, even Ananda went away and he was just leaning against a post somewhere, just crying. And we said he'd lost all understanding of the Dhamma. He was so attached to the Buddha as his teacher that he said the Dhamma just disappeared. It depended, because he wouldn't always have somebody fanning them, because sometimes it was cool, sometimes it was warm, sometimes the Buddha was by himself at night time. But Ananda was the main sort of attendant. And even Ananda, when he agreed to be the Buddha's main attendant, he even actually almost like struck a deal with the Buddha, I'll be your main attendant, but if you give any discourses when I'm not there, please let me hear them. And so that's one of the reasons it said that even when there was a discourse when Ananda wasn't attending on the Buddha, such as even this one, it would be like the Buddha would actually repeat it to Ananda, so Ananda will be kept in the loop, as it was. So that's how I understand it. I don't think there's always two. Sometimes there was no attendance at all. The Buddha was by himself. I know sometimes people say, when I travel overseas, why don't I take an attendant? And of course I do. They're called flight attendants. Any other questions? Yeah?
Someone translated Vijnana as happiness-seeking program.
Oh, really? Yeah. Interesting. Well, happiness-seeking program, that's a bit strange. But it's sometimes when you say something, you throw it up, who knows? After a while you think, it doesn't make any sense. But anyway, there's some questions from overseas, and then we can finish off. It's gone. Press the wrong button. Help! It's gone to cessation. Uh-oh. Very good. I have to press the wrong button. Okay. From Malaysia, what is the main role of Vinayas for a monk and a nun and its relationship with their enlightenment? Vinaya is like a training. So that's what it actually means. Even just a restraint training. So we have those Vinaya rules, restraints. Many of them I thought when I became a young monk, I thought, oh, these are just not really worth it anymore. You know, such as little rules. No, please excuse me, a monk should not be alone in a secluded place with a woman. And I said, well, you know, sometimes you know, you've got to be kind and they might want to have sort of a personal interview. But then, if that happened, then, you know, I could be sort of accused of all sorts of sexual impropriety. Who knows what happens? And because, you know, that Ajahn Chah made us make sure that we kept that rule very carefully, that is one of the reasons why that they look at the conduct of our monks and nuns and, you know, there's, you know, if somebody accuses you of, you know, the sexual abuse of somebody, where, how? You know, it couldn't have happened. Because we never put in those situations. The same with the nuns. You know, the nuns, one nun should not be alone with one man. You know, because some people is the what I call the suspicions of the malicious. You're opening yourself up to criticism. So there are those Vinaya rules, you know, for monks and nuns, which I thought, well, you know, you've got to be compassionate. But it meant that you avoided a lot of trouble. And you see now with monks accused of nuns and priests accused of all sorts of skullduggery, and much of that is true. So it's protected us from such claims of abuse. And why we give teachings always for free. We never actually charge for anything. So, you know, there's no such things as scams as a monk. We don't do things for money. So it means that, you know, we don't have personal funds. So, you know, you can't say that Ajahn Brahm goes overseas and lots of people give lots of money, but it always goes to the temples, never goes to me. No, I don't mean that. Which is great, there's no temptation there, which is wonderful. Yeah. It's not just being pure or trusting one another. It's just there's always some malicious people who would, you know, try and find ways to destroy reputations. It's the same as even the monks' quarters over there or the nuns' quarters. You know, that a long time ago when Ajahn Gunha came to visit, and there's a nice place in there just in the little reception area. So, you know, he had couple of female disciples. And they're really good people. But he had them in there, so you can see them coming in. And I said, no, no, please don't do that. This area over here is only for males when the monks are there. And so he said, oh, yeah, sorry, sorry. And he said, you know, that he understood. So the same as the nuns over there. Men should not go into that nun's quarters, you know, when they're in residence, as it were. Because imagine what it might look like. Even some years ago, that I was, I forget where, but I was, I think it was in the terrace hut over in Bodhinyana, and I saw Ajahn Bhumali just walking down the hill alone with this blonde young woman. And I said, well, Ajahn Bhumali, what are you doing down there? He said, that was my sister. Sister came to visit. And I said, oh, yeah, I didn't know that. But you know, sometimes you see from a distance and think, what's going on? So that's why it is, you know, well, if you're going to go sort of with somebody, just make sure there's another monk or man around somewhere. Because otherwise people see and they can create lots of mischief. So Unfortunately, some people are like that. You've got to put yourself in a position where there's no temptation, and it's also there is no possibility of being misunderstood.
Was a neighbour who was trying to tell me that how come there hasn't been any misdeeds done with the monks in the Buddhist society. Yeah. And when I said, well, there isn't, it's set up differently, they wouldn't believe me.
Yeah.
And I said, well, no, they just don't put themselves in those situations because their aims are slightly different. That they, you know, were willing to create mischief.
That's right, yeah. It's true, that, because the main persons from the ABC who were doing those investigations, they've been through all the different types of religion, scouts and stuff, and then they rang me, because I'm a sort of senior, well-known Western monk, and they were talking about, well, you know, is there any scandals? Have you dealt with them in the Buddhist tradition in Australia? Number one, we don't have schools. There's a couple of schools started in New South Wales, but we've never really been involved in schools. And even in Jhana Grove, you know, that on retreats, I think it was 18, I think, is the minimum age. Was it 16? I think it's 18. 18 for people to go on retreats. So we try and make sure there's limited, you know, possibility of being, you know, with children underage. People who do not have the power to choose. And so a teacher-student relationship can be abused. And at the same time, that we have female leaders. Because this was only 6 months ago, and the as it just happened, it was about a year ago, I said, well, actually, at this time, the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia is Venerable Hasapanya. That was that month when I resigned. It was fortunate that she was the boss. And that she was also the president of the Buddhist, the Australian Sangha Association, and Cecilia Mitra. You know, she was the president of the Federation of Australian Buddhist Councils. So, you know, we had sort of females in some of the top positions, and I know from my understanding of religions, when the hierarchy is dominated by patriarchs, by males, there always seems to be possibilities for such abuse. But when you have sufficient females in top order, then it seems to be one very good way of preventing such abuse. That's just what I've studied and heard and seen. So it's great. Cecilia is still the boss of the FABC. And the Federation of Australian Buddhist Council, Australian Sangha Association, the boss is Bon Yom Sunim, as she's a female. But unfortunately, on yesterday's AGM, I couldn't find a way to resign my spiritual directorship. So I'm still spiritual director for the next year. Anyway, that's just a bit of a jokey. Anyway, is there any sutta which tells about enlightenment of bhikkhunis? Yes, from Germany. Yes, there is the Terigata. There's lots of stories about the bhikkhunis' enlightenment. There's a whole section of suttas. The Terigata, the verses of the elder Teris, female enlightened bhikkhunis. And they're inspiring. So, yes, they're there. Okay, so it's time I should get back to monastery. Three times the Buddha Dhamma Sangha, and then we can go off to do what we need to do. Sadhu. Okay.
Arahaṃ sammā sambuddho bhagavā buddhaṃ bhagavantaṃ abhivādhe. Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammanamassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sangang Namami.